Good morning, Oregon. Thank you once again for loading me down and queuing me up. This is another daily episode of the Offbeat Oregon History Podcast, which every weekday brings you another story from the archives of the Offbeat Oregon History Syndicated Newspaper Column. You will find the full details of all that stuff at offbeatoregon.com. Do check that out. But first, sit back and relax, and let me tell you the story of Rajneesh Puram and how, according to certain law enforcement agents that were around at the time, it almost could have turned into an Oregon version of Jonestown. Unlikely as it sounds, law enforcement people who worked the case think it really easily could have ended up in, this is a quote, a bloody mess. I know. If you lived through that whole episode, which I did, I lived in Portland at the time, you'd think of the Bhagwan and his people as kind of like a bunch of kind of goofy, free-love, peacenik people with a really loud-mouthed and obnoxious and condescending voice in the person of Ma Anand Sheela. But you may also remember seeing pictures of red-clad guys with Uzis and stuff. There was an edge to that bunch. Well, here's the story, which, by the way, was first published in the newspapers on May 30th, 2010. The story of a small and secretive cult of people deciding to go out in a blaze of glory rather than submitting to outside authority is a familiar one these days. Harking back to the infamous story of Jonestown, Guyana in 1978. Familiar, but outrageous enough that most people think it can't happen here. Yet, if you ask certain law enforcement people who were on duty in the mid-1980s, they'll disagree with that. Some might even tell you that in their opinion, it almost did. In late 1985, after the public split between the Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh and his erstwhile spokeswoman, Ma Anand Sheela Silverman, the Bhagwan invited police to enter Rajneesh Puram to gather evidence against her. What they found was chilling enough, but in the context of the Rajneesh group's earlier predictions of catastrophe and Armageddon, was kind of truly frightening. They found two laboratories set up to produce biological and chemical agents that could certainly be used as weapons. They also found some books detailing how that might be done, one titled Deadly Substances, another titled Handbook for Poisoning, a third titled The Perfect Crime and How to Commit It, and another one, Let Me Die Before I Awake. These were some of the titles that were found in what appears to have been Ma Anand Sheela's personal library. Well, a few days later, the Bhagwan started getting considerably less cooperative. Newspaper and TV people poured in from all over the world, and law enforcement people started to complain that they weren't being allowed to do the job that the Bhagwan had invited them to do. Then came the spark that could have blown the whole thing up. A court in Portland issued a sealed indictment against the Bhagwan on an immigration violation charge. This presented law enforcement officers with a serious problem. It was now their duty to go and get him. But for some time, the Bhagwan Peace Patrol, as they called it, had been furnished with particularly warlike equipment, including the Colt AR-15 rifles that were the civilian equivalent of the U.S. Army's main weapon. Officers had been there long enough working on the Sheela investigation to know the place was well-armed and arranged for defense. A few weeks before, the Bhagwan had announced that his followers no longer had to wear the distinctive red robes that would, in a worst-case scenario, mark them as members. Police in the compound, both investigators invited in by the Bhagwan and undercover agents posing as followers, warned darkly that any attempt to serve a warrant on the Bhagwan at the compound would probably turn out into a bloody mess. Luckily, the Bhagwan solved the problem for them by chartering a Learjet and trying to flee to Bermuda. Thus, instead of having to invade a heavily armed compound with an enormous SWAT team, authorities simply had to dispatch two U.S. Marshals to intercept him in North Carolina during a stop for fuel and pick him up, which they did. Authorities later learned, according to Pinterich's account, that the Peace Patrol did in fact have a contingency plan for how to respond to an attempt to arrest the Bhagwan. It involved encircling the leader with a human shield of women and children while security forces shot to kill. If all or even if most of the participants in this plan cooperated, it would be hard to imagine something like this ending well for anyone. The Bhagwan's arrest was the end of Oregon's Rajneesh experience. Well, sort of. Sheela, arrested in Germany and extradited, pleaded guilty to several poisoning and arson attempts and was sentenced to 20 years in prison and ordered to leave the country immediately after serving her time. The Bhagwan was simply deported, with a prison sentence suspended on condition that he leave immediately. Sheela, after being represented by powerful and expensive legal teams both in Germany and in the U.S., suddenly became unable to afford to pay $270,000 of her fine, There had been $57 million in cash and hard portable assets, mostly jewelry, on the Bhagwan's books. Now there was no sign of it. And to this day, authorities have no idea what happened to it. Maybe it was quietly embezzled by one of the sannyasins. Sannyasins, by the way, was their term for followers of the Bhagwan. Perhaps the Bhagwan managed somehow to smuggle it out of the country for later use in building his luxurious meditation resort in India, which he later did. Or perhaps it's simply buried somewhere out there in the high country of North Central Oregon, waiting for someone to come back and dig it up. We'll probably never know. Here's an afterword. Sheila's husband's death. Mahanand Sheila Silverman was released from federal prison in 1988 after serving 29 months of her sentence. She immediately married a sannyasin from Switzerland by the name of Urs Bernsteel and left for Switzerland with him, leaving Oregon authorities in the lurch for more than $60,000 in court-ordered fees and restitutions and such. As a spouse of a Swiss citizen, Sheila was now eligible for residency, and after 3 years of marriage, she'd be eligible for citizenship. And Switzerland in particular very seldom cooperates with other nations' attempts to prosecute its citizens. By choosing Switzerland and marrying Bernsteel, Sheila had become safe from further prosecution. Now, Sheila was originally arrested in late 1985, so after 29 months of prison sentence, this marriage would have taken place in late 1988 or early 1989, right? Well, in 1992, Bernsteel died of AIDS, which Sheila told Willamette Week magazine he had contracted after the two of them became separated. Thus, Bernsteel apparently in the course of 3 or 4 years got married, got separated, contracted the HIV virus, developed full-blown AIDS, and died. A timetable without parallel, so far as I know, in the history of human experience with this disease, when it is naturally acquired. I have been unable to find any explanation of, or even reference to, the fact that a disease that usually takes at least a decade to even manifest itself killed Bernsteel in less than 3 years. It also must be pointed out here that Sheila had a particular fear of the AIDS virus, stemming from Rajneesh Puram's experience with the Share a Home program, in which great numbers of hard-living, hygienically challenged homeless men were invited into the compound in an attempt to take over Wasco County. Sheila also had a history of dabbling in harmful biological agents, most especially the cultured salmonella bacteria with which the salad bar in the Dalles was doped. And let's not forget those books about poisoning that the cops found in the compound. Now, so far as I know, there is no evidence that Sheila had anything to do with her late husband's death. No evidence at all. But this pattern of facts can be construed to add up to something remarkably dark. That's all I'm going to say about that. Well, that's it for today's episode. And if you're listening for the first time and want some more information about Offbeat Oregon history, you can get everything at our central website at offbeatoregon.com. That's the complete catalog of about 205 columns going back to 2008, plus links out to audio and text feeds on RSS and iTunes, and to the Facebook page and Twitter feed. The website's also where you'll find full citations to sources for this story, which for today's episode include books by Bill Gulick and Wynn McCormick, plus an article in Willamette Week. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band, atlasstringband.com, written by Carmen Ficarra. This podcast is covered under Creative Commons license. For details of that, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. Coming to Corvallis, please do drop me a line, and let's grab a cup of coffee and talk history. I'm at Finn at Offbeat Oregon, and if you do Twitter, at Offbeat Oregon will get you to me. And that is it for today. Tomorrow I'm going to read you a short story that was published in The West Shore, a literary magazine in Portland, in 1887. It's called The Hermit of the Siskiyous. It's a gold mining legend, almost certainly made up, but the author doesn't really represent it one way or the other, about a mysterious stranger who comes to town and strikes it rich and disappears, and no one can figure out where his diggings were. So look for that after about 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. In the meantime, go fill up the rest of your Christmas with good stuff. Bye now.